Hey, how's it going? I'm Lee McCormick. Welcome to Tramps Like Us, Bruce Springsteen Podcast, Episode 51, Tunnel of Love Album Review, Side 1. It's February 2018, Valentine's Day is upon us. I'm going to take this month and focus the podcast on one of my favorite Springsteen albums, Tunnel of Love. I have some great episodes to release this month, digging in deep on Bruce's 8th studio record. We're kicking off Tunnel of Love month here at Tramps Like Us with an in-depth album review episode. Two great friends, Craig Smith and Randy W. Hall, join me to give our thoughts on the album and unpack it song by song. Craig Smith is from the Pods and Sods Network, who, along with Eric Miller, lead many different music podcasts focusing on diverse artists and clever topics. Check him out on iTunes and at podsodcast.com. Randy W. Hall, along with his co-host, Handsome Dan Menard, host That Dandy Classic Music Hour, an hour-long music podcast, two friends playing tunes, waxing poetic, telling jokes. Have a listen at iTunes and at thatdandyclassicmusichour.com. Stay in touch and updated with this show via the Facebook group and the website trampslikeuspod.com. Subscribe on iTunes, leave a review and rating and all that stuff. This is the first of a two-parter album review episode. Craig, Randy, and myself breaking down side one of Tunnel of Love by Bruce Springsteen.
Mainly, I wanted to write songs that I could get up and sing without being embarrassed, you know, at the particular age that I am, you know. I've tried to write to my age all along the way, for the most part, you know. You know, matter of fact, when I wrote the Born to Run record, when I was questioning that record and its value and its worth after it had come out, you know, I had a lot of different feelings about it myself, you know. At the time, you know, we had just been successful, and I was very doubtful of myself, you know. Like, at the end of that record, you know, I look back at it, and I tended to say, well, maybe this was good for now, you know, but these people have to go someplace. It's not just good enough that they go. You know, they have to go. Where are they going? They have to go somewhere, you know. You just can't go. Can't go all the time. You know, you gotta have, for it to have meaning, there has to be someplace you're going. But you can't find it unless you strip the illusion away. You know, you gotta strip away the illusion and find out what is really there. It's the only way you can really get next to it. Whether you're that guy and born in the USA, you know, and you're dealing with social, you know, the social forces, or whether you're, you know, whether you're the fella in Cautious Man, you got to strip away the fairy tale.
So we're going to do a Tunnel of Love album review. So I picked a couple of my great podcast buddies to help me out with this. I got Craig Smith from the Pods and Sods Network and Randy Hall from That Dandy Classic Music Hour. How are you guys doing today?
Woo!
I'm excited.
All right. Super Bowl weekend. We're approaching Valentine's Day. You know,
I'm told. I know more about Valentine's Day. Album appropriate for this time of year.
Yeah, that's why I figured we would do this, get this out for this appropriate occasion. So just before we get started, just give a quick background on your Springsteen fandom or not there. So Randy, when did you become a Springsteen fan, or what kind of fan are you?
I would say I'm a moderate to severe fan. No, I'm not as severe as Lee McCormick over here, but I went through my Bruce phase in the mid-90s, I would say.
Yeah.
When he came out with that Greatest Hits, it had its intended effect on me. Of course, I knew who Bruce was. I'm a little younger than you two. I'm 42. So born in the USA, that was a big deal when I was a kid. And of course, I knew all those songs. And then it's funny, I was living in Detroit, and Detroit didn't get cable TV available to us until 1987 for some reason. And I do remember, especially Tunnel of Love and One Step Up, got a lot of airplay on VH1.
Yeah.
So, and I actually remember watching an MTV special on the Love Town tour at the time. So I was always primed to like Bruce Springsteen. And I got this album in particular for sale sometime in the early 90s on tape. And I found myself listening to this album in Darkness on the Edge of Town the most.
Right.
Out of all of his catalog. It still remains that way to this day. So that's the Cliff's Notes version of that.
All right. And Craig Smith, for people in the know, fans of your shows, the Pods and Sods Network, and you've made a few slight appearances on my show before, but you kind of have mixed feelings about Springsteen, right? So why don't you tell us about that?
I would say that I'm a poor to moderate Springsteen fan, depending on the era. I discovered, my childhood was Born in the USA on cassette, the live box set on vinyl, Tunnel of Love and Chimes of Freedom on CD, and I probably dropped off sometime around Lucky Town and Human Touch.
A lot of us did.
Really? Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, I'm not as up on the trajectory of things, but I do like to play a character on the Pods and Sods Network that's a Springsteen denier, because it's a fun character.
Right.
And, parts of that might come up throughout this episode, but having said that, Tunnel of Love is one of my favorite albums of all time. And I think where my problem, when I do have a problem with Springsteen, it's, and I know that people love him for this, it's the kind of simplicity that a lot of his songs employ. On this album, there are crazy, crazy good arrangements and chord progressions, and this is the kind of thing I gravitate to. This album is just absolutely genius, in my opinion. So I'm going to be as respectful as possible. Don't bring up any of the crap that's on Born in the USA.
All right, well, we'll see what happens. We'll see where this is going to go. All right, so let's get into this Tunnel of Love record, which was Bruce's eighth studio record. And the way I kind of look at it, is this is kind of the last record of that, really, really big period that he put out, like maybe Born to Run to Born in the USA, Tunnel of Love, that sort of, five or six albums in there, which were all, really phenomenal. Released October 9th, 1987. I didn't get this record till maybe, I don't know, I forget when I would pick up records back then. Like these days, if I want some, I just get it right away. But back then, you had to wait a while till you could get the funds. So I probably got it maybe early 88. I got this record. And
I can't be the one on this panel who got this record first. That's just not right.
Really? You did it? You got this kind of soon?
I think I did.
Yeah.
I think I got it right when it came out. Yeah.
Like I was hip to all the videos. Like this was the video age, and, Much Music and MTV were, playing these videos a lot. And I loved the videos, but, I don't think I picked the record up till a bit later. Randy, when did you grab this? You said you got it early 90s, right?
Yeah, I want to say 91, 92. There was a used record store that I would go frequent and spend all my hard-earned money at. And this was one I picked up because I knew the singles off of this album. I liked all the singles, so that was my entree into the album.
Yeah.
And when I actually got it, I was like, wow, this is not what I expected at all. And it seemed, it had a lot of parallels to me to Nebraska, but with a maybe better dynamics and a more of a budget. And when you read the story of the album, of how he got a lot of home studio equipment, that makes a lot of sense because he didn't have his band with him. And even, I know it's not an E Street Band record, even though they appear on several of the songs.
Yeah.
But it makes a lot of sense that it is a lot. It's like a higher budget Nebraska in some sense.
Yeah.
And listening to it, in the last decade or so, I would say that it's actually like a secret alt country album. Like, I honestly think that almost all these songs could be country songs.
Yeah, the writing, very intimate and personal, you know, subject matters he's dealing with. So it is very much a solo record, the same way Nebraska is, only this time he's using, you know, higher quality equipment, whereas in 82 or 81 when he recorded that, he just had an acoustic guitar and a four-track machine, where now he's got, you know, some drum machines, beat machines, and he's got keyboards and synthesizers and, you know, a better kind of home studio that he's working with, you know, which lends itself to some of the intimacy of these songs.
I unconsciously planned to make a record that the band was at home, but it must have been in there somewhere, just as... I think what I liked was it was a very peaceful working process. It was kind of relaxed, and the record was an intimate record. And it just felt right for that record. You know, there wasn't a lot of people around, and, you know, it just lent a certain intimacy to the whole thing. That was part of the record, and I wanted the record to be, you know, non-mythic and just real, and I suppose smaller is not the right word, because I think it's a big record, but I guess austere, you know, just sort of real clean and very arranged. It's my most arranged record since Born to Run. You know, it's just kind of what felt close to me to write about and do at this particular moment. I suppose my life was more structured during the making of the record than it's been. You know, we worked 6 hours a day or something, and then the songs came pretty easy. You know, they weren't really, I don't remember really struggling. Mm-hmm. I worked on them, but I didn't like do what I used to do, you know. So,
which was what?
Which was just obsess, you know. I was a guy that had a lot of energy and just, you know, I would just look for places to put it. I could work on something for 2 hours or I could work on something for 10 hours, you know, and the result may be the same, you know, or not as good sometimes, but I just had the energy to put into it, and I didn't have anything else to do, you know. I didn't have anything else to really, my life was very one-dimensional for a very long time, you know, all from when I was, you know, 14 or 15 to when I was into my 30s, you know. It was just music. It was okay, it was good, but, you know, there's other things.
The last thing I want to say on all that is, I like Nebraska too, but I would pick this album any day over Nebraska, maybe because it is more fleshed out in the arrangements.
Yeah. Easier on the ears. Like, it's a very much a pop record too, right? Like, there's some very, you know, pop sensibilities that he's really got a hold of at this point in his career, the 80s.
Like, if this, I don't know if this is where his twang really started. It might have started like in Darlington County and working on the highway.
Wait, Craig mentioned it.
You know what, Randy? Fuck Wayne and fuck you.
But his twang on these songs is evident on almost every track.
A lot of us singing from the soul too. Like, this, it's a very kind of sterile sounding record with the uses of all the keyboards and the drum machines and stuff like that too, right? But there's elements of soul and country I hear in this too, you know. And a lot of that I think could be responsible to the little, you know, the little sprinkling of E Street members that he put in through some of these songs, where it's, he's recording most of the bed tracks, but he'll put Max in there for a lot of percussion. He'll put Patty in for some background vocals. You know, Nils does one solo. So these little moments kind of bring some of those soulful elements to this, you know, otherwise sterile sounding.
A lot of that's the 80s, too.
Yeah.
87, I don't know how you guys feel, but 87 is one of my favorite years ever for music. And this album is just one of the reasons why. I mean, I could rattle off 5 to 10, like, really awesome albums from 1987. So,
I mean, all you really need is this and Crazy Nights. Whoa!
Yeah, well, hey, what about Out of the Blue?
Well, I wasn't going to bring Debbie Gibson into this podcast, but...
Yeah, bring her in.
We're looking at my pile, yes, that's on top.
Aaron Trent Darby? I mean,
it's great. No, 87 was a great year. I remember it a lot because it was the year that I got my first CD player. So I remember, you know, there are certain years that you can just, like, rattle off a list of songs that came out that year.
Yeah.
And I think that for me, like, just getting a CD player and you know, having this new format and buying just like, I had just gotten a job. I was 14, buying as many CDs as I can. So yeah, 87 is an absolutely magical time for music for me too.
Yeah, it was awesome. I mean, it's sign of the times, Craig. I know.
Oh, well, come on. You can't go wrong with that.
Yeah, 87 too. That's like right when I'm 13, you know, I'm just becoming a teenager too. So like I said a bit earlier, though, when this album came out, you know, I was big into Born in the USA, big into that live box set. So this next record I was kind of expecting was going to be along those same lines. But, you know, as a 13-year-old, I didn't really connect with the more mature Bruce that you see on this record. You know, that he's in the suit and the bolo tie kind of thing. You know, so even some of these songs kind of sound, you know, adult contemporary. Like, I remember hearing some of these tunes on the radio station that my dad listened to, right? Or like on the Muzak playing in banks and malls, like they would play Brilliant Disguise and One Step Up and stuff like that, right? So I didn't really give it much of a chance then. I love the hits, but, you know, some of the slower stuff on here I didn't really grasp then. But as I grew older and matured, learned about love and heartbreak, you know, firsthand, like this record really started to speak to me. So now I embrace these songs, you know, like, so, you know, once I'd loved and lost, like Sinatra, you know, like when you've loved and lost the way Frank has, like, you know what life's about, right? So
I mean, when you've loved and lost the way Frank has, then you you know what life's about.
You come to the realization that boy meets girl is not the end of the story,
right?
Well, I guess was going through a rough time and it didn't survive this album and tour as we know now. So And if you read his book, and I know Lee has, he struggled all his life to that point, maintaining relationships just because he didn't trust people enough to let them in.
Yeah.
And I mean, that comes through a lot in these songs. I mean, Bruce has always been good at that, but it's like this has a different depth than some of the stuff that came before, as far as, you know, being a husband is different than being a boyfriend.
Right.
I mean, it just is. So, you could just tell, like, it's cutting deeper for him, which is to our benefit as listeners.
Like, so he's always kind of struggled to lead that full, complete life and balance his career and his fame and his stardom with, like, a, you know, a solid, loving relationship and a family life, right? So I guess here he's in a period where he's newly married and, you know, he's just had, like, huge stardom success, but he's kind of still wrestling with some internal demons that aren't, you know, satisfying them.
This record comes at a time, I mean, when it's sort of like into the Cinderella story, you know, world's greatest rock star marries world's most beautiful girl, lives happily ever after, and then comes out with this record about, like,
yeah,
a really unusual thing to come out with. I mean, what was going through your mind when you put these songs together? Did it just sort of flow out of you?
Yeah, they were just the songs I wrote, you know. They were just, I suppose they were the way that I made sense of what was happening to me, and I made it was the way that I feel I made sense of what was happening to me, and the way that I made it real to my audience, you know, because you're right, people do, you know, everybody wants the story with the happy ending or the fairy tale, or you wanted it when you were little and you want it now, you know. It's like people, you know, it's popular, but for me, it was, I suppose it was a way that I would make what was happening, make people deal with what was really, I felt, you know, just sort of happening, you know. And it just seemed healthy. It seemed like this, the thing that I guess I've always been sort of concerned with, you know, I want my audience to respond to me basically as a person, you know, as a human being. And I want to be able to respond to them in that fashion, and I feel that's where the value of the relationship lies, you know. I'm not here to play out some fairy tale.
Can I ask you a question, Lee?
Yeah.
For years I kind of got the impression that this was kind of the music from the Elder and his catalog. Like, people kind of pushed it to the bottom because of its 80s production and things like that. But I the more people I talk to about it, the more people seem to really love this album. Is that like an unfair Was that a thing?
I think so. Speaking firsthand, like, that's how it was for me. You know, like, yeah. Like when I was 13, like, this album didn't resonate the way the other records in his career did up to then. And then, yeah. like, right after it, he put out Human Touch, Lucky Town, which is another kind of step down. You know, it's kind of like the Unmasked to the Elder.
So?
Well,
yeah, how so is that a step down?
Well, he's just leading to this way that's even further away from the river, further away from darkness. Like, those E Street Band records that kind of gave him his sound. Mm-hmm. This is a left turn from that. And then he goes even further away from this, where he moves to, you know, L.A. and he gets rid of the entire band except for Roy Bittan, you know, and then he's moving more towards this kind of slick 80s, early 90s production kind of thing, right? And then he goes into the 90s where he starts to do even more weird things like soundtrack songs and, you know, Streets of Philadelphia and, you know, even you know, just really going out on a limb with, you know, what's expected of him with his style of music he does, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But then but then, I don't know, like, years go on and you realize just how good some of these songs are, and, you know, this record especially, you know, me personally, this is probably my top five Springsteen records. I love this one so much, and a lot of fans, you know, you'll hear the same thing, I think.
Awesome.
Top two for me.
Top two.
Yeah.
All right. So one thing too that we were talking about is the usages of the drum machines and the new sounds on this. One thing I wanted to say is that I read a thing with Max talking about this, and Bruce had recorded everything with a drum machine, and he called up Max at the end of the recording and just saying that he wanted to, like, humanize some of the sounds, loosen it up. So Max at the time had no idea that Bruce was even recording, so he just found out last minute, and Bruce said the album's almost done, and invited him over. So Max went to Bruce's house, a small home studio. This was all recorded, like, in this little, like, guest house outside of his New Jersey place there. And he said he played the record for Max twice in a row. Max's response was, "Wow, that guy is really confused." And Bruce responded, "Exactly. This character goes between 51 and 49% certain that he's made the right or wrong decision. He keeps going back and forth between the morality of right or wrong." You know, Max would play, add little percussion things, overdub toms and drums onto these drum machine grooves on 8 of the 12 songs. You know, Nils would play one solo. Clarence, Roy, Danny, and Gary would make minimal appearances, and Patty sang on a few songs.
I don't think that the album suffers too much from not having an E Street Band, but I think it's one of the reasons he never plays these songs live. Or I shouldn't say never. He rarely plays these songs live for couple of reasons. Number one, it was a painful time in his life, and number two, he wants to include his band. So I think that's the saddest part for me as a fan, is that a lot of these songs he won't do. So
he did do them in 2005 on the Devils and Dust tour, which was his solo tour, right? Like, we're not E Street Band tour, but he was doing theater shows, and he was doing, like, solo performances on piano, acoustic guitar. He ended up playing a lot of these songs for the first time.
All of them,
yeah. Like, eventually, he got them all out there. And there was, like, on all the fan sites, people were like, "Oh, he's played 8 of them, or he needs to knock out a few more, right?" And finally, by the last show, I think he played one of them.
Valentine's Day was the last one.
Was Valentine's Day, yeah. And, like, at the show, you hear, like, about, you know, 10 or 20 people in the know just, like, lose it as soon as they start the song.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, he did One Step Up when I saw him. On that tour.
Did what now?
He did One Step Up when I saw him in 2005.
Ah, awesome. There you go.
Yep. And yeah, Thundercrack.
I didn't have enough money. It was kind of expensive for me back at the time. But yeah, he Joe'd stuff, his Devils the Dust stuff, and stuff from this when he's by himself. Maybe he needs to try that again once he's done with Broadway.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so shall we get into the record? Let's knock this thing down track by track. So, first song that opens up the record is "Ain't Got You."
I got the fortunes of heaven and diamonds and gold. I got all the bonds, baby, that the bank could hold. Well, I got houses across the country, honey, end to end, and everybody but wants to be my friend. Well, I got all the richest baby any man ever knew. But the only thing I ain't got, honey, I ain't got you.
Yeah, man. Hey, you're a big Elvis fan.
Oh, yeah.
Was this inspired by Elvis to a certain extent, do you reckon?
Sort of. I actually hear a Bo Diddley vibe on this, right? Like the She's the One feel is like that Bo Diddley beat, the bump, 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 bump. So that's the Bo Diddley vibe on this. So he's playing, you know, acoustic guitar and hand percussion, finger snaps, harmonica. This is one of the you know, two or three songs on the record that is entirely Bruce, no one else on this. And, you know, this song is kind of looking at your successes in life, the fame and fortune, popularity, but realizing that that doesn't mean shit if you ain't got the girl you want, you know. I think, like, just as the entire album, Tunnel of Love, is a left turn from Born in the USA, there's no mistake that, you know, when you first drop the needle on the record, that this is something, you know, completely different than Born in the USA. You know, sort of a short song to introduce the record.
Yeah, it's like a message. He's sending messages right off the bat.
That's right, yeah. This ain't the same record you heard before.
Like, this is a different kind of party, y'all. Yeah. Either you're in, this is what it is.
Yeah, sort of mocking his Born in the USA celebrity, you know, like, kind of acts as a very effective bridge to the themes of Born in the USA together to the themes of Tunnel of Love.
Yeah, I mean, as a song, like, it sounds like a B-side to me. If I was I'm looking at it kind of critically, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't think it's good enough to be on this album. I don't dislike the song. I'm more indifferent to it. I think there's a place for this song in his catalog, because Bruce is infamous for, you know, leaving good songs off the albums if something serves the album better. But I don't think this album serves any other purpose than to tell people, hey, look, man, this isn't Born in the USA.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's good enough on that merit to merit its inclusion when you have so many other better songs you could have put on that would have probably served the mood.
What about you, Craig? Thoughts on this?
I have to agree with Randy on that point. I tolerate it as an opener. It's not my favorite kind of Bruce song. I do think that it might have been better suited as a B-side, but I think that I would be annoyed by it if it was slapped in the middle of the album somewhere.
Yeah,
I think it's kind of, you know, it to me, it's an intro and that's it. It's short, gets the point across. But yeah, it's one of the weaker tracks on the album. It's an interesting opener.
Yeah, I think its purpose is an opener to the record to set it up, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I concur with that assessment. I would say that is he bragging, humble bragging, just being a smart ass?
Yeah.
All of the above.
Well, it's funny you say that. A guy that took kind of issue with this song is little Steven Van Zandt, actually. Because I guess before the record was put out, Bruce played the song for Steve. You know, Steve recognized the self-mockery and he called him on it. He said, Steve, this is a quote I have here. He said, Steve's talking, "We had one of the biggest fights of our lives," Van Zandt recalled. "I'm like, what the fuck is this?" And he's like, "Well, what do you mean? It's the truth. It's just who I am. It's my life." And I'm like, "This is bullshit. People don't need you talking about your life. Nobody gives a shit about your life. They need you for their lives. That's your thing. Given some logic and reason and sympathy and passion to this cold, fragmented, confusing world. That's your gift. Explaining their lives to them, their lives, not yours. And we fought and fought and fought and fought. He says, fuck you. I say, fuck you. And I think something in what I said probably resonated." So that's what Steve said. I think that might be a bit harsh, you know, but...
I don't think the song is worth all that now.
Yeah. Well, it was the 80s. These guys were fired up. They had tempers back then, I guess. I don't know, but...
Put on part man, part monkey, and be done with it, man. Come on.
But the one cool thing I do dig about this song is the way it segues into the next song. It's a very, you know, I do dig the segue from the acoustic, you know, Bo Diddley vibe of Ain't Got You into Tougher Than the Rest.
You're all dressed up in blue.
I've been watching you for a while. Maybe you've been watching me too. So somebody ran out, left somebody's heart in a mess. Well, if you're looking for love, honey, I'm tougher than the rest.
Right off the bat, a masterpiece. I love everything about this song. Those bars of two on the verse at the end of the verse add so much to the drama and the movement of the song. The yeah. sporadic harmonies are magnificent. I'm going to get a little music theory geeky in some of my notes here. Cool. But that the move to D minor on that bridge is heavenly, and the harmonic outro is perfect in a way that the harmonica on Ain't Got You is not. But I love this song. Perfect song.
You know, two people sizing each other up in a bar. You know, maybe it's wrong, maybe it isn't, but it's kind of a song about surviving that, you know, committing to someone even though, you know, past relationships may have failed, like giving it your best again. That what doesn't kill you makes you stronger kind of thing. Admitting your faults and shortcomings. You know, it's like Rocky, right? I love Rocky. You know, the Rocky VI, Rocky Balboa, Rocky has that great speech where he's talking about, you know, it ain't about how hard you hit, it's about how hard you can get hit and still keep moving forward, you know, so.
Let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, it will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is gonna hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done.
This song is like that vibe too, right? I love the guitar solo, that Dwayne Eddy-esque, you know, low neck guitar solo. You know, just drenched.
You don't expect it.
No, just drenched in echo, right? Like just not up the neck of the guitar and just screaming, but just very... You know, just, you know, heavy down, rumbling, low E strings and stuff like that. And, you know, then that contrasts with what you're saying with that harmonica solo where he just busts it loose at the end and just, you know, lets it wail on that harmonica with all the emotion.
I gotta say, this one, like when I was younger, I don't think I appreciated this song as much as I do as an adult. I think the tempo to a younger person, like in their teens, 20s, I think the tempo might not suit their ear because it didn't to me till I was in my 30s and 40s. But this one's really grown on me a lot over the years. And I've got to say, this album is real bottom heavy, meaning like I think the second half is much stronger than the first half overall.
Yeah, I agree.
For sure, yeah.
But on side one, this is definitely a highlight. And I agree, like, my note says, Lee, the guitar seems to be some countrified Dwayne Eddy tuning.
Oh, good ears, Randy.
I mean, to me, that's the thing that really makes the song good.
Right.
Also, lyrically, it's a real winner. I mean, Bruce, the reason I was a big fan of him and remain so is he's always been his lyrics may be simple, but sometimes... his simplicity hits at a lot of truth.
Oh, that's the thing, yeah. That's the art.
That's the art of Bruce Springsteen. He actually, like, if you ever listen to my show, That Dandy Classic Music Hour, my buddy, my partner in crime is Dan Menard, but his stage name is actually Handsome Dan.
Wow.
So I didn't realize he literally said Handsome Dan.
Some girls, they want a Handsome Dan.
You know what? I got to tell you, I always thought it was Handsome Man. And when I put in our chat, Handsome Dan, I thought I was making a joke about your co-host.
Wow.
And apparently that's the lyric. I never realized that. Or I realized it at some point and never, you know, it just never sunk in.
Dan's not a big Springsteen head, so I doubt he got it from this song. Yeah, this song, like that, when it's fading out, the organ harmonica combo at the end. I just think that is awesome as it's winding down in the last 20 to 30 seconds. It like seals it with a kiss. Right. And I think, you know, in side one, this and one other song, which I'll talk about later, are the definite highlights. So.
Yeah, one of my favorite songs on the record. The one thing I'll say about this is I do prefer the live version better than the studio version. The video that was released for this, this is the fourth single off the album. It was a single in Europe, not in the U.S., but they made a video for it. But I do remember seeing the video, and the video was a live performance. And the tempo was actually slower than the album version, which is odd. You'll rarely hear a live version that's slower than the studio version, right? And this,
it's more smoldering.
Yeah, it just sits a little better with just that, you know, a couple BPMs, less on this song. So, yeah, I do love that live version. Especially, too, you get Patty and Bruce singing on the mic together, you know, in the midst of their smoldering love affair, you know, making eyes at each other, which is just, it's heavy, kind of powerful stuff.
Yeah, that video says it all. You reminded me, I had that, I guess it was 1990, that VHS, the video collection.
Right.
And that was on there. Wasn't that live version Tougher Than the Rest? Is that also on Chimes of Freedom?
Correct, yeah. I'm not sure if it's the same version, possibly.
But there's a live one on there.
Yeah,
right?
But the live version is a similar thing where it's the slower version than the studio.
Yeah, I listened to the hell out of that one, too, as a kid, the live version. Awesome.
Next third track on the record is All That Heaven Will Allow.
I got a dollar in my pocket. There ain't a cloud up above. I got a picture in a locket. That says, baby, well, if you didn't look then, boy, then fellas don't go looking now. Well, if she comes a-walking, hell, that heaven will allow.
Probably as optimistic as this album gets. It's not bad. It's not great. When he says, come on, Slim, slip me in, man, that's probably the one lyric that will come to me whether I like it or not. Come on, Slim, slip me in, man.
Isolate that.
Yeah.
Slip him in. But it's okay. I don't think it's a bad song. I don't think it's a great song. It's okay.
Yeah.
It kind of is moving along. Like if you're into album pacing, which I know Springsteen is, I see why it's where it is.
Yeah, true. I see that.
It's not a real strong third track. Usually on most albums, the first and the third track are real strong. Well, this one goes counter to that that theory.
Yeah, right.
Because I would say, you know, the first and third tracks are middling at best. But I do like it when he does this with Clarence, because this is one of the places where Clarence can actually interact with him, or could have interacted with him.
Yeah, on the live songs. You know, some good bass playing on this track by Bruce. Yeah, Bruce plays all the bass on the record except for one song, and some really cool bass parts on this. He's playing like a bass player, you know. So, but this is another one of those songs that's kind of, I was saying, it's kind of adult contemporary. For me, you know, like it's got that soft drumming with the cross stick, and it's got the soft, you know, keyboard sounds. I prefer the Mavericks country band. They did a cover of this, which I prefer. They kind of do a little more rock, and drums are a little bit more slamming on it, which is cool. You know, Bruce singing background vocals with himself sounds really good. The song "The Bliss of Being Completely, Utterly in Love and Fearless of Trouble That May Be Coming," you know.
Well, I think if like you and your sweetheart have this as your song, it'll have a lot more meaning. I never had that kind of heavy emotional meaning with this song. I mean, but that was a Bruce song. I mean, it's definitely middle of the pack.
Yeah.
I like the title better than the song. How about that?
Always great lyrics, just the music doesn't really hit it for me on this one. What about you, Craig? Any thoughts on this?
Yeah, pretty much the same. I like the story it tells. I think I like the lyric more than I like the arrangement and the melody. It's not in my tier of favorites on this album. I wouldn't skip it. I like the chord progression on the outro quite a bit, though.
It definitely has its charms.
Yeah.
You know, I think you summed it up perfectly. I wouldn't skip it, but definitely. I mean, where it is in the album is where it probably ought to be.
Right.
Sides, like album sides, but you know that cart, that horse already left the barn. So.
Right.
All right, so the next song is a song about a woman struggling to understand the value of her own independent existence.
This is a song about a woman struggling to understand the value of her own independent existence. The value of the life of her child. Put down her old dreams, the parts of her past that are keeping her down. Trying to find something new and beautiful and meaningful in her life today.
So, spare parts we're talking about. Spare parts. Song's pretty self-explanatory. I don't think there's any hidden messages in this song. It's a, you know, an accidental pregnancy and a father who runs away from it. You know, it's got that third verse revelation where, you know, Janie thinks about going down to the river to drown her baby son, but instead she goes back home to hawk her wedding dress and ring and carry on. You know, they've got characters in this song, Bobby and Janie. I'm wondering if they're the recurring character names from the Born in USA. Is this Bobby Jean? And is this Janie from Janie, Don't You Lose Heart, you know? Bobby said
he didn't have a big wide pool of names to choose from.
Yeah. Kind of leaned on the same name a lot, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, he talks about he wants, the way he writes records throughout his career is he's taking his characters kind of on a journey, you know, like from Born to Run, through Darkness, through the River, through Born in the USA, through Tunnel of Love. These are all characters in different stages of their lives, right? Just the way he's going through different stages in his own life.
Interesting.
Bobby was an asshole, a self-absorbed bastard.
Bobby said he'd pull out, but Bobby stayed in. What an opening line, eh?
Oh, yeah, right off the bat. Songs don't usually come at you like that.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Lee, when you weren't you on Worst of Springsteen on Rocking Into a Roll, and BJ picked this song as one of the worst ones?
Yeah, BJ picked a couple songs off this record.
I go, yeah. We all have a. It's cool. Yeah.
Well, we know that BJ is wrong a lot of the time.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
He would. I think he'd say the same about us, though.
Yeah.
I'll fight him on that.
Oh shit! It's gonna get for Nashville Pod 2.
Nashville Rockin' Pod 2 with another face-off. Well, that's what makes it cool, man. I love that we all agree on certain things and we all disagree passionately, you know, with each other on different things. You know, it makes it
cool. I mean, I'm cool. No, I'm cool when you guys do it. I'm just not cool when BJ does it. That's all.
All right.
You know, can I tell you what might be an unpopular opinion about this song? I like this song, but I don't think it fits this album.
Not really. It's not as personal and intimate as the other songs, you know. He's just
And just like musically, I think that I would kick this song off first, even over like It Ain't Got You, even though I like it more. It seems so much different than everything else on here.
This is the one song that's kind of rocks, you know. I guess he wanted to get one rocker, and you know, Gary Talent plays bass on this song. It's the one song he's featured on is this. And
well, you know, this song actually sounds like a John Fogerty song to me from like the center field era. That's what I get out. Like when I'm hearing it.
It's got some blues, swampy blues groove kind of thing to it. You know, the slide guitar and the harmonica played by Jimmy Wood on this. It's got some distorted effects on it. You know, weaves in and out with the slide guitar lines and stuff like that.
Yeah, like I could see this on like an episode of Miami Vice when they're in the swamp, you know. Yeah,
a little Smuggler's Blues vibe.
Well, you know, drug deals going down in the marshlands, and you know, Crockett and Tubbs are waiting at night, or waiting for it to go down, and Spare Parts comes on. So
here's one thing. I don't really get the title Spare Parts. What does that refer to? Spare Parts and Broken Hearts keeps the world turning around.
That. He's equating these two characters, Bobby and Janie, are kind of on the white trash side of things.
Yeah.
And they're looked at as society as spare parts in the grand scheme of things.
I gotcha, yeah.
That's
makes sense.
And I also have a note in here to Janie that, hey, man, there's always adoption. If you can't, there's a lot of parents out there, yes, who would gladly get a child off their hands. So
there's always another option than, you know, taking your baby down to the riverside, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, this one and the next one, like, when I would look at the lyrics, you know, I wasn't sure how those stories went down, especially the next song, but I'm glad that she empowered herself and traded in that wedding ring and dress for some good cold cash. That's a good resolution there. On the next song, I'm not as clear on the resolution, and maybe you will fill me in, Lee.
All right, so next song we're talking about is Cautious Man.
Bill Orton was a cautious man of the road. He walked looking over his shoulder and remained faithful to his code. When something caught his eye, he'd measure his need, and then very carefully he'd proceed.
So it's kind of a song about a well-traveled man on the road, you know, struggling with that restless heart, you know, feeling the coldness rise up inside him that he couldn't name. You know, it's almost got a... like, I want to see me even like almost a suicidal vibe with, as this character kind of battles internally with, you know, love and fear. What should he do? You know, it's kind of even unsettling as the song ends without real closure. Like you said, Randy, like, I don't know what this guy is going to do. There's you know, is he going to remain faithful, or is he going to give in to these temptations of the road that he's always seen? You know, this song could probably be, you know, the closest lyrically and musically to something off Nebraska. You know, this is another song that's just entirely Bruce. Acoustic guitar, a little mandolin, little keyboards on this.
Yeah, that's my note on here, is it easily could have been on Nebraska or even the river.
Right.
Got that kind of like intimacy to it. And when I saw Bill Horton in relation to you, I'm like, hey, I wonder if this guy's kin to Tim Horton.
Tim Horton,
up there.
Yeah. Famous hockey player, donut entrepreneur.
Have you ever heard of Bill Bits?
No.
Like Tim Bits.
Thing? Bill Bits.
Like Tim Bits. Come on.
Oh, I got
Tim
you.
Bits?
Bill Horton.
Tim
Bill
Horton?
Bits.
Bill Horton?
Bill Horton Bits.
Tim Bits? Wow.
I got you,
right?
I got
you,
Craig.
Started it,
right? I got you, Craig.
Thank you.
But I this one really is a good headphone listen. Like, if you're working out at the gym and this comes up on the shuffle, it might bring you down.
Gotcha. Yeah.
You're in a contemplative mood late at night, you know, and you're open to the story that he's telling. It is kind of cool that he tattoos love on one hand and faith on the opposite.
Fear.
Did I say faith?
Faith. Well, yeah.
I meant to say,
that's right. A George Michael song.
Yeah, but also from.
That's right.
But which one he held his faith in was never clear. That's a memorable lyric. But yeah, this song is, I mean, it's kind of like whatever mood I bring to it is what it gives back. If I'm contemplative, it's a more rewarding song than if I'm not dialed into it, then it just kind of escapes me, kind of thing.
It's real honest songwriting, you know, from Springsteen. Like, this record he shows, like, I can almost see this song being autobiographical. You know, he's the man of the road, obviously, on tour, and he's got his new wife at home, and he's kind of torn between these two lifestyles, trying to make a, you know, a fulfilling family life, yet still, you know, satisfy that restless heart that he has, you know. And, you know, this album shows that he's writing honest songs, and he's just trying to be very real to his audience. You know, no fairy tale writing on this record.
Craig, what's your take on this one?
I love this song. I think that this is where the album really starts to hit its stride for me. I really dig the arrangement. That little break before the third verse is a really nice touch. Has he ever rocked the vibrato like he does on this elsewhere? Right? Like it's a Springsteen I'm not used to.
Yeah.
He does some of your favorite Springsteen tropes where, you know, he kind of like the here's his terrible face.
Well, yeah, that is in there. Nothing's I think the big offender on this album for me is in Ain't Got You when he says the word watch and starts it with an H.
Watch. Oh,
big diamond watch.
You know my favorite thing you say as Springsteen is chord. Can you just give me one of those?
If I was yeah. I like to write songs with three chords in them. Like that?
That's the one.
Sorry.
That's my favorite Craigism.
I'm the only man that built a whole career on learning 2.5 chords. Yes, I know it's not true. Keep your hate mail.
Jungle Land has like 18, 19 chords on it, by the
way. Okay, on my Facebook page it said 12. Make up your mind.
Well, there's a key change. I don't know if we count that. Do we count key change?
Hey, I'll totally give Springsteen credit on the songs where he does that, but like a Glory Days? No.
See you and BJ Cramp in there with your you can't handle like minimal chords. Like that's where it is, man. Blues chords, three chords. Two chords, one chord, man. Like, if you can make some rock on one chord, you're a king, man. Bo Diddley.
Look, you have to at least give me this, Lee.
All right.
There's nothing more ridiculous in the Springsteen catalog than Springsteen saying, rock it now, and then that mandolin solo. Come on.
I will give you that. That is kind of...
He might as well just pulled out like a goddamn music box or something.
He should have said something besides rocket. He should have said like, come on, Steve, or let me hear it. Like rocket doesn't equate with a mandolin, but
your mandolin.
I like how he plays the song at the end when he's done and he goes, woo.
All right. I got it all out. I think we'll be good from this point on.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. So let's go on to the last song on side one is Walk Like a Man.
I remember our fear and felt on my wedding day, and the tears cried on my shoulder, I couldn't turn away. Well, so much has happened to me that I don't understand. All I can think of is being 5 years old, following behind you at the beach, tracing your footprints in the sand, trying to walk like a man.
Yeah, buddy. Now you're this is where the album picks up steam for me, personally.
All right.
This is one I played at my wedding, ironically.
Right, right. Yeah, you mentioned that you were you stopped by when we were at the Nashville Rockin' Pod. You mentioned this one there, right?
Yeah, I didn't realize it at the time, but I think he wrote it about his dad. But when I was dancing with my mom for my dance with my mother, I had him play this because I don't think my mom ever thought I'd get married.
Right.
So I always had that bachelor's heart and soul about me until I met my wife. So probably not unlike you two gentlemen. Yeah, so this song always meant a lot to me.
I think it works for either parent. You know, it works for like, you know, someone just flashing back to, you know, your parents and, you know, how you've misunderstood them and how you've revered them. And, you know, this is somebody kind of seeming like preparing to get married, take that transcendental step, you know, to the next chapter of life and looking for that role model to carry on.
I just like how it starts too. Like it starts hot. You know, I remember our of your hand fell.
Yeah, just vocal right off the top, right?
Yeah, I mean, you start no lead in. It's just a straight into it. Doesn't waste any time.
That's right.
So, and I always, I mean, the way that they use the synthesizer in this, it actually adds a lot. Like, it's understated.
Yeah. Cool little Bruce keyboard solo on this, eh? He plays the, I think he plays everything on this, maybe? Or no, Max is on this, but yeah, Bruce definitely plays the keyboard solo on this.
Yeah, he did a good job. I don't think he's known for his keyboard soloing. This is where the 80s production actually maybe even serves it. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of moments on this album where I think it could only be done in the 80s, and it actually sounds, it's about as well as that kind of thing could be done for the time.
Absolutely. The one thing where I mentioned earlier about bringing a little bit of soul and human touch, pun intended, to this record is, you know, Max calls it the Try a Little Tenderness beat, right? That sort of Otis Redding, the cross stick on all four, which he brings into this song, which kind of brings it, you know, a little bit of a soul vibe, a little feel on this song, which I like.
Yeah, amen. What do you got for us, Craig Smith?
Great side ender for those of us listening on the vinyl format. I know that Lee is. I don't know about you, Randy. I'm a big fan of descending chords, and the verse here is really, really nice. Great minor key. I love the A minor on the instrumental break that's kind of hinted at during the bridge. Two things, though. First of all, just a funny thing. We did an episode on Tunnel of Love on Pods and Sods 3-4 years ago in the beginning of our run, and this was before we did research.
We thought
that we could just come in and talk about a record, and I think it was like halfway through talking about this, one of us was like, I think this is about his dad. Like, none of us even got that or realized it until one of us was looking at the lyrics and was like, well, I think we're on the completely wrong path. So research is good. Yes. Let's talk about the keyboards on this album, though, because Lee, I know you know Mr. Brian Jacobs. He's been on your podcasts, and he was on our episode there, and he's on a bunch of episodes with us. He's not a fan of the keyboards on this album, and really not a fan of that keyboard kind of sound that Bruce uses a lot. I really like it. What do you like? I guess this is a perfect example is the keyboard on this. I think specifically, you know, kind of like those airy keyboard sounds that he uses. I think it's great.
I love it too. Yeah, it sounds good. It really, I don't know, it just gives it a feel. It just sounds like a guy like busting out demos in his, you know, little guest house. Like it's very personal. Like he does the keyboard solo, and it's not like, you know, virtuosic, but it's, you know, it fits. It's good. It's coming from a songwriter's perspective, you know.
But what about like the keyboard sound itself, like the My Hometown kind of keyboard sound? Like, do either of you guys have issues with that sound?
Like, I think I used to, but now I've warmed up to a lot of 80s sounds. Like, you know, when it was going down at the time, and in the 90s, I always kind of was like, you know, I like some 80s, but some of it is really awful. But now I'm very warmed up to those sounds, and it's, you know, it's a lot of nostalgia for me too, you know, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd never had the issue with any of the keyboards on his records that I've heard.
War on Drugs. You guys ever listen to that band?
No.
It's called War on Drugs, and I think that they take what was good about 80s keyboards and add it to modern music. So if you're got the time to check out War on Drugs, I think if you like this keyboard sound, Craig, I think you might enjoy that as
well. Yeah, I think I'm the only person in my workplace that doesn't listen to them, because everybody mentions War on Drugs, and I just never have checked them out.
Then, like, you mentioned My Hometown, and yeah, I mean, it's like he's going in a different direction tonally with the keyboard. Like, Tunnel of Love has a definite keyboard tone.
Yeah.
It's like its own orbit, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if it was the way, like, what the keyboard he was using, because I'm not a musician. Or something like he just played the same keys over and over.
Right. I don't know,
but like, there's just something about the keyboard of this specific album that is, it's all, like, he doesn't use it anywhere else that I can pinpoint.
Okay.
I think it's coming from, he's trying to make, you know, an independent record similar to the way he did Nebraska, but he's got some new toys, right? He's got some drum machines and some keyboards to play with that he didn't have 5 years earlier. So, This is what he came up with when he sat down to write on it.
Right.
And he's going through a terrible time in his marriage. Yes. So it's all same time.
And I think fighting with Stevie Van Zandt over lyrics.
So, but this record was a record where I really, it just, you know, I only wrote one or two extra songs besides, you know, besides what's on the album, and it was just very, as an album goes, I felt it was real. It was my best collection of songs that came at one time that pertained to a certain idea. And it was stuff that I felt I had not written about before, except very sparsely, you know, so it was new. It was a new experience. It was a new, some new ideas, and so I was happy with it, you know. I didn't have any, usually right when I, before I put a record out, I have a lot of, you know, conflict, you know. When I didn't, with this record, I didn't, you know, it was like, oh, okay, you know, glad to see it, you know, glad to see it come out. The stuff came very naturally, you know. I didn't have some, I didn't have an idea except like, well, I want to sort of write about, you know, I want to write some love songs, and so it was about it, you know. That was the main, and do it sort of in a way I felt it hadn't exactly been done before, you know. And just to expand the range of, you know, the, my characters and the people that I've been writing about, and you know, just broaden people's perception of them and give them other lives. And, you know, that was sort of, I guess that was my main goal, sort of.
That's the end of side one. Hope you enjoyed that. Gratitude to Rainey and Craig for their insight. Side two coming soon. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
That's the show, folks. Thanks for listening. You can find us on our website at trampslikeuspod.com, communicate with us on Facebook at our Tramps Like Us podcast group page, and on Twitter at Tramps Like Us Pod. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on iTunes, where you can leave a review and a 5-star rating. Tramps Like Us podcast is a nonprofit audio fanzine created by fans for fans and is available for free. We are not affiliated with Bruce Springsteen or Columbia Sony Records. If you've heard any music you like, please find it and purchase it from brucespringsteen.net, iTunes, Amazon, your local record store, or wherever music is sold. As always, gratitude and respect to Bruce Springsteen and all past and current members of the heart-stopping, pants-dropping, hard-rocking, booty-shaking, earth-quaking, love-making, Viagra-taking, history-making, testifying, death-defying, legendary E Street Band.
Come on, slip me in, man.